So we had talked a little bit last week to introduce the subject of the death penalty debate in America. And we spoke about the fact that there is a perception, which may be correct, may actually be the way things are, that if you were to ask a Jew who's steeped in Jewish tradition as to what this tradition tells us about the death penalty, it's that, on the one hand, we clearly have it on the books, that's undeniable, but on the other hand, it's something that's never supposed to be applied, or to be applied very, very rarely, very sparingly, as implied by the Mishnah in Makos. And we know that it could be that's correct, but we have to accomplish a little bit of the journey before getting to that conclusion. Because, to be accurate, we have to recognize the fact that every source that talks about the death penalty can be relevant to at least three different contexts. And the contexts were, on the one hand, the setting of the Sanhedrin, the topic of our entire Masechta for this year, where you have Jewish ritual law enforced with all the protocol of Edim and Hasra and the like, that we talked about extensively last week and synergistically throughout the week, because it also worked very well with the topic that we were talking about as the week went on, and that we have to continue a little bit tomorrow. And that's one arena. And in that arena, yes, it's true that death penalty is probably very, very rarely going to be applied, because the circumstances necessary for it to come about with Hasra, and with Kabbalah Hasra, and with Edus, and with all of the above, and with the role of Itzilu Eid that we spoke about during the week. Indeed, it's going to be difficult. We also added the point during the week that Itzilu Eid perhaps also tells us that Mises Bezdin should only be applied when it's definite circumstances, and that that's more than the halacha of Safek Nefashos Lahakel, but that that is inherent in what the death penalty is, that there is a relevance only when it's a definite situation, only when the person is amazed in the absolute sense, as we saw in the context of Hasra. So all of that is a part of the Sanhedrin system. And we frame that in the context of the Machloket, the Rishonim, how to count Mises Bezdin as a mitzvah. We saw that the Ramban counts it as one mitzvah, V'yarta hara mikarbecha, which we understood as a focus on society and protecting society from harmful elements. On the other extreme, we had the Bahag, who counts each key of Misa separately, which we understood as a defense of the law, that every time there is a Avera which carries the death penalty, there's a separate mitzvah to protect that principle. And in the middle, we had the Rambam, perhaps the least intuitive position, that we should count four mitzvahs, Skilas, Reifa, Harig, and Chanek, and we explain that as correlating to the different levels of Kapara, and therefore him understanding that that's the focus of Mrs. Bezdin, to provide a Kapara, to provide an atonement. So we then moved on to the second context. We talked about the fact that there is also a notion of Mishpat HaMelech, that when there is a danger to society, so then you find that the Melech or the Sanhedrin working in a Melech-like capacity can take extra legal measures, whether it's somebody who poses a particular spiritual threat to society, or it's someone who is a physical threat, somebody who's running around killing people, but for some reason not being careful enough to make sure there's always two Edim and Hasra when he does it. So how to address situations like that, we find various tactics and various techniques to address that outside of the general legal system. And we mentioned that that was invoked in the modern era in the discussion of what should happen in the contemporary state of Israel, should they have the death penalty or not. And the rabbinic view at the time was that the only framework which was applicable was that of Mishpat HaMelech, and therefore we're not in a position to impose a kapara on anyone or any other such value. All we can do is keep society safe. And therefore, The assumption is that if we have lifetime imprisonment as an option, so then that can keep people safe from offenders, and we don't need to actually execute anyone, a debatable assumption, but that was what was put forward at that time. And that basically gets us to today, to the third stage. So far, so good? Any questions? Any issues? Any problems? All right. So the third stage, which on the surface should be the most relevant, is the concept of Din by Bnei Noach. And Din by Bnei Noach is also a topic in Masechta Sanhedrin. Really, all these issues are Sanhedrin topics. Thank you. And the Gemara is surrounding Daphne Ches, which is always easy to remember because it spells a Noach, and Masechta Sanhedrin, tell us about the mitzvos of Bnei Noach. And we know that essentially there are seven mitzvos of Bnei Noach, which could end up being more if you assume that they're grouped differently than the 613 Jewish mitzvos are. So there are a number of svarim which will give you longer listings, because they'll assume, let's say, for example, like if some sofer writes in a tshuva that gezel is inclusive of many other principles, which for tayag mitzvos would be counted separately. So whether it's really just seven is subject to a lot of discussion. But for now, let's assume you have seven mitzvos, which break down into six prohibitions and one single positive mitzvah. And that positive mitzvah is the mitzvah of din, is the mitzvah of justice in the world. So what does that mitzvah ask for? So that's a topic of debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. I believe we put on Rambam and Ramban. It's not necessarily where you would expect each position to be. That the Rambam in Mishneh Torah tells us the pshat and the story in Tanakh, which is not usually where you look to find such things. But the story of that we find in Parshas Vayishlach of Shimon and Levi slaughtering the town of Shechem. So the Rambam writes in Hilchos Melachim, I believe it's Parakas Halacha Yud Aleph, that this was justified because of the Noahide code, because of the mitzvah Bnei Noach. Now we have a mitzvah of din, and that mitzvah requires that we police the society, basically, that we enforce the other six mitzvahs, the six prohibitions. So since Shechem, the individual, was guilty of gezel, the way he puts it, in his attack on Dina, so therefore it was the responsibility of the city of Shechem to punish him. And because they didn't do that, so therefore they were all in violation now of the Shechem mitzvahs Bnei Noach. And the principle is, as we mentioned throughout the week, Azharason Zohim Yisason, there is a death penalty associated with all of the prohibitions, and therefore they were all Chayiv Misa. So the Ramban, his commentary to Chumash, to Parshas Vayishlach, the Ramban challenged this. The Ramban says he has a lot of objections. I mean, first of all, it seems like the Rambam is justifying this, and it doesn't sound from the Torah like they did the right thing. We see that Yaakov is angry at them. And if they were right, then Yaakov should have done it. And even if you're going to tell me that Yaakov was too old and he was afraid, okay, so then he shouldn't be angry at Shimon Levi. So the Rambam's position is difficult to sustain for that reason. And the Ramban has other objections. The Ramban says that the assumption that Asarasan Zogim Nisasan is the Chiyuv Nisa for all the violations of the Bnei Noach code, that's true only for the prohibitions. Just like we find by Jewish law, that there are punishments associated with violating transgressions, but for the most part, you usually don't find them for neglecting mitzvot. So to here, we have a punishment associated with the Avera, but not for the Bidul Mitzvah of Din. But he also writes that he understands the mitzvah bin differently. And this is a point we discussed, I think, on our first day of shiur this year, when we noted that it parallels a similar machlokes to Rambam and Ramban in the mitzvah bin for Jews, which was an eye-opening observation. But here it says, here the machlokes is explicit. Says the Ramban, the very, very big chiddush, that the mitzvah of din for Bnei Noach is that it is inclusive of essentially all of Choshen Mishpat, all of the rules of Shomrim and the like, that Nezikin, all of that is included and applicable to Bnei Noach. It's a very striking position. It's really surprising. I once heard a shiur from Shlomo Fischer Shlito, where he was talking about this machlokas, and he said, in case you think that there are that it's not such a surprise, the Ramban's position, to say that Choshen Mishpat applies to all of humanity, because it's all intuitive anyway, it's all civil law that we could have figured out, so therefore it's not so surprising to say it applies to everyone. So to that he said, there are more Gezeir Shavas and Kal V'chomers in Bav Metzia than there are in Parah Adumah. That it's not like you can figure out all about Metzia on your own without a Torah. So the assumption that this is universal is a big one. It's a big surprise. So, but that seems to be the Ramban's position. So essentially, we have a machlokas here. We have a mitzvah of din, and we have a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, how that mitzvah of din is applied. And it's a pretty significant machlokas, right?
How are they not supposed to know all of their Shabbos?
Oh, so that's a very good question. So that's a big question on the Ramban. So presumably that carries with it an obligation of education on our part. There is some extensive discussion about this in Chuvas Machna Chaim, a few others far, talk about the question of how much education are we assuming. And on the one hand, so the Ramban discusses the Hukos Malachim, that we don't have the same kind of requirements as far as Hasra and as far as Eidim and as far as everything that we talked about in the first category, which we assume is associated to the ritual role. So yes, we don't have all of that, but we do have a basic fairness. So it's got to be that it was at least possible to know about these things. And we talk about, there's a whole literature as well, about the concept of Omer Mutter and the status of halacha of somebody who can't tell whether you want to call him a shogeg or a mezid or an ones. He's somebody who thinks something is permissible. So if he does the avera because he thinks it's permissible, so what do we call him? Do we call him a shogeg? Do we call him a mezid? Do we call him an ones? So in the context of Bnei Noach, you do find the phrase hayelo lomo that he should have learned, but as the post can point out, that it would seem like it has to at least have been possible, that if you don't have a society where there is any potential education, then it can't punish without anything. So clearly there has to be an assumption that there is something being understood. I believe, if you know correctly, Matan Chaim writes in his Shuvas that therefore that means that we're obligated to educate society about these principles. Otherwise, they can't be expected to be held responsible.
Could it be there was like a Masorah from Noach?
Yeah, it could be. It's an interesting question which has other implications, maybe for a different time, the question in general about how you have mitzvot Bnei Noach that are a topic of debate discussion with somebody about this a week or two ago. You have something, it's machlokas, the mechasinach, and the dvar avram, and the mitzvot Bnei Noach. So how exactly is that supposed to play out in real life? The 7 billion people who would be subject to this issue never heard of the dvar avram more than the mechasinach. So how exactly does that play out on a practical level? It's one thing, okay, so we have a machlokas between Reb Moshe Feinstein and Reb Avadja Yosef. Okay, so you have a population that looks up to Reb Moshe, a population that looks up to Reb Avadja, and they'll decide these positions. But here you have a machlokas where the constituency is affecting would never have any connection to the discussion. So that's an interesting question, how exactly to relate to that. That's a fair question in general. But that's essentially Ramban, especially Ramban the Shittaso, is not assuming that everything is a Chiyuv Misa. So it's a little bit easier to deal with. But basically the Ramban is saying that at least in theory, all of the principles of Choshen Mishpat apply, and there's a lot to figure out about that. The Rama is a tshuva where he thinks this point is a machlokas in the Gemara, which today is in the Gemara, about what the sources for the Chiyuv of Din. So it's a whole debate. Okay, David, do you have your hand up before?
So for the Rambam, because all the questions reply, so they're not, they wouldn't be deserving of Mita. That's like another proof against.
Well, it's two things. That one is that they're not chayav misa just for neglecting din. That's a betel asay, and that just like we find in Jewish law, that betel asay is generally not subject to an onesh. So too, that would be the case here. And also, he disagrees with the thrust of the Rambam. The Rambam is basically saying that the function of din is that you have to enforce the other mitzvot, and he's saying that that's not really what it's about. It's about regulating and monetary law. It's about having a civil code, and it's not so much about an obligation to enforce the other principles. And therefore, it comes out for two reasons, that it's two levels of separation from the Rambam's position. Hi.
The Rambam said that?
I'm sorry?
The Rambam said that?
The Rambam said these points in response to the Rambam. Did we put the Maror Hamas last week?
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully we had a chance to see this. Yeah.
Does the Rambam say that it has to be our Choshen Mishpat? It says they have to set up a Choshen Mishpat.
Well, it seems like the Rambam would say that they just have to set up their own principles for regulating monetary law. So the Rambam really sounds like he's saying that it's our code, our Torah principles are really applicable to all of society, which is quite interesting, to say the least. There is a fascinating tshuva of none other than Hagon of Nosson Gishtetner, which highlights a little bit this interplay between the Rambam and the Ramban, and also ties to our topic last year, the Ksubas, that it had to do with a woman who was a Holocaust survivor, and she was receiving reparations from the German government. So her husband wanted to claim the stake in that money, claiming that it's his money. So the question came to Rav Nosson Gishtetner about how do you assess the money that she's receiving from the Jewish government, from the German government.
Husband wasn't getting the money at all.
The money was going to be paid to the wife. Money was going to the wife, but he claimed that based on marital law that it should be his money. So
not cool.
Not so cool, right? It's not a good way to endear yourself to your Holocaust survivor wife. But in any event, so he, Nelson Gishtetner, considered the question. He said, we first have to figure out what is the category of this money. That if we assess that it's Dmei Chavala, that it's money that gets paid for personal injury, so then that is indeed the wife's property and not the husband's property. So if that's the proper category for this money, so then the woman wins, the wife wins, so to speak. But
what's the category?
Dmei Chavala. It's money that's paid for being wounded, for physical injury. So he says, you see from the Ramban, the Choshen Mishpat applies to all of humanity, that the din of Chov v'Chavero and the associated payments, that applies to Bnei Noach also. So therefore, they're also obligated to pay Dmei Chavala based on the Ramban. And therefore, it makes sense to say that the money should be viewed in that category and should be her property. So then he notes, but wait a minute, but you might say that it's not the Mechavlim who are paying here, that the Nazis inflicted this injury, and the ones paying the reparations are the German government, which is not the same, they're not the same people as the Nazis, it's a new regime. So maybe we should say that yes, theoretically, if the Nazis were paying this money, so then it would be Dmei Chavala. But if other people are paying the money, then it's Tama Matana, it's Tama gift, it's not in the category of Dmei Chavala. So to that he said, that's where the Rambam comes in. That the Rambam tells us that part of the mitzvah of din is that society is obligated to enforce all the other principles. So he basically combines the two. He says there is a chiyuv Dmei Chavala that was incurred by the Nazis, and the German government, because of the Rambam, has an obligation to make sure that that Dmei Chavala gets paid. It's a creative combination of the two positions, and therefore he says, from that perspective, this money is still called Dmei Chavala, and the husband is not cool, and the wife gets to keep the money. So it's a fascinating combination of the two positions. So, I'm sorry?
You said that.
This is Rav Nosson Gishtetner. Which the veterans know is a frequently quoted name in this room. Nasan Geshtedner was a posek in Bnei Brak who passed away at this point, let's say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the author of the Shuvas Laharus Nasan, as well as Laharus Nasan on Chumash, and Laharus Nasan on Pirkei Avos, and a sefer on Gemara called Nasan Pirio.
Yes, as I believe on the Moed.
Yes, also called Laharus Nasan. Yes. Many, many svarim. It's very prolific. I have many more manuscripts if anyone is looking to donate any svarim that I have not yet been published. But in any event, that's what he writes about this. So it would seem that, let's try to get this major point out, that it would seem that really the din of Bnei Noach is really what we're talking about. If somebody would ask you, if somebody's going to say to you, listen, I'm a congressman and I'm a good friend of you, a good friend of yours, and I respect your tradition, so tell me, how should I vote for the legislature? Should I vote pro or anti the death penalty? What does the Torah say? So, if he's talking about American society, so it would seem like really the code of Bnei Noach is where you are. If that's really where we're paying attention to, and that the code of Bnei Yisrael is not really applicable. Rav Shechter tells a story in Nefesh HaRav. I've heard a little bit back and forth about the accuracy of the story. I know some relatives of people involved, but I most recently told that this is the accurate version of it's the Nefesh HaRav, that when the Rosenbergs were going to be executed, the Rosenbergs were charged with spying for the communists and who were ultimately executed. So the rabbi in Sing Sing, Rabbi Kozlov, so he called the Rav, and he said that they're scheduled to be executed on Shabbos. And maybe we should argue that this is against their religious rights, because Beis Din does not impose Mrs. Beis Din on Shabbos, so it's against their religion, so we should object to this. So the Rav's understanding, the Rav's response to this was that really that's an inappropriate mixing of the system. So yes, Beis Din doesn't execute on Shabbos, but the United States government is not bound by the halachas of Beis Din. They are Dinei Bnei Noach, and they carry out their laws the way they carry out their laws. So they're not subject to the rule of Dinei Nisan B'Shabbos. So on the surface, he didn't really think that that was a legitimate argument. But he writes there in Shechter that the Rav also thought that maybe the Rosenbergs weren't really guilty, that it was McCarthyism that had brought about a little bit of paranoia, and that maybe try to do what you can to save them. So, if you have it pushed off a day, it'll be Hatzalah Porta, that's at least something. But it backfired, according to his report, and instead they were executed on Friday. But it highlights the point.
Meaning earlier.
Right, they pushed it up instead of pushing it down. But it highlights the fact that we're dealing with different systems here. We don't really think that the rules of the Sanhedrin should apply to the rules of Bnei Noach, the courts of Bnei Noach. They're both systems that are recognized by Allah, and they are distinct from each other with their own rules. So now the problem is, if we assume that Bnei Noach is the guiding force, so if we said that Azarasim Zohim is awesome, so now things have flipped. So now you're basically saying that really we should support the death penalty, and not only that, we should support the death penalty for Ganavim, for anybody who, for adulterers, for anybody who violates the Noahide code, should be Chayav Misa. So you don't really see anyone maintaining that position. So how do you explain that? Yes, sir?
We just clarifying, if American law is supposed to like Bnei Noach, so they're supposed to get Misa for pretty much any of the Sheva Mitzvahs?
That's what it sounds like from the Gemara, right? That all the Sheva Mitzvahs are subject to a Chayav Misa. So if that's going to guide our policy here, so then we say, all right, so then Bnei Noach, you're Chayav Misa for everything. That's what we should tell our congressmen. So you don't find anyone saying that, and if you have to leave right now, don't leave thinking that that's the policy. So it's an interesting question, why isn't it? In the Sefer, Chalkis Yov, he has a little bit of an answer, which doesn't really address the whole thing, but he mentioned recently the Sefer Kavya B'Kashay, so 103 questions. So in the context of one of those 103 questions, he has a little bit of an approach, but it's only a partial approach, where he suggests that when you're talking about mitzvos ben odom l'chavero, so then the starting point of the chiyuv misa But the society under discussion could define a lesser punishment too, because that would mean that they are mochel on the full punishment, and they have the right to be mochel, so therefore they could do that. So let's say, for example, the ganavim, so they could say that, all right, so if there was no rules in society, if we had no codes, we had no constitution, so then you'd be chayav misa for stealing. But since American society has gotten together and decided that you don't get executed for stealing, you go to jail instead, so then that is kind of a societal mechila on their rights to enforce their protection against stealing through killing people, and therefore that's valid. Hi.
In the Jewish system, would you be able to be mochel on the same thing?
You mochel for Geneva, you mochel on
the same thing? Let's say you mochel on some death penalty situation.
Well, most of them aren't benavim mechaver, that's why it's a little hard to find an appropriate example. So you have to figure out what's going to... Whoever has them, that's an interesting question. Maybe that might be a good example. Figure out exactly how that would play out. But also here, the assumption is that it's not the individual being mochel as much as that society somehow can be mochel in that right. It's not a full answer, because it's not going to address all of our questions. So there is another approach to take here.
Why doesn't it address all of
that? I'm sorry?
Why doesn't it address all of that question?
Because you can still be chayav misa for a zara, for example, and then you have to also figure out if the sicha is maybe not really been on the machadero, and it probably is not going to fully satisfy us. But there are other approaches as well. So, I'll tell you a little story. So, many years ago, you can figure out how many years ago it is, because you see it's tied to an external event. I was in a store and I saw a New York magazine. Yes. So I saw a New York magazine on the shelf and it had a headline, it had a cover story, The 100 Smartest New Yorkers. So I got to find out who the 100 smartest New Yorkers are. So I opened up the magazine and I was happy to see on the list that 2 out of the 100 smartest New Yorkers were associated with Yeshiva University. So.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good ratio, right? 1/50th of all the smartest New Yorkers are associated with YU. So right now, neither of the two are still associated with YU, though. So one was Professor Oliver Sacks, who just recently passed away, and who had in recent years not been associated with YU, but at the time he was on the faculty of Einstein, which is also associated with YU anymore, but he at the time, both he and Einstein were at that time associated with YU, and so that was that. And the other was Ravon Soloveitchik. So the only problem with the Ravon Soloveitchik listing is that, first of all, he wasn't a New Yorker, he lived in Chicago, and would commute to YU, and also the picture that they had in the article was a picture of the Rav. Okay, but...
Was the Rav alive at
this time? No, they met Ravon, but the picture happened to be a picture of the Rav, so, okay. So it's still nice, but could tweak a few things. So since it's only a magazine, it's not a book, so they couldn't have a whole chapter for each person telling you just how smart they are. So the only way they could prove how smart each person was is they had a little little bio, a picture of the person's brother, and then a quote, basically one quote to show how smart they are. So the quote for Ryan Soloveitchik, so now here you can figure out when this was. So Governor Pataki, previous governor, had just been elected governor, and you know, you're not old enough to remember this, but he was elected on a pro-death penalty platform that Mario Cuomo, the senior Cuomo, had been the governor before, and he had been anti-death penalty, and Pataki ran on a bring-back-the-death-penalty platform. So Ravon Soloveitchik, who happened to have been a big political liberal, so Ravon wrote that Governor Pataki, you should be very careful with the death penalty. The Talmud says that a Sanhedrin that kills every 70 years is a bloody Sanhedrin. You should be careful to make sure that New York State doesn't become a bloody state. So it sounds like he's essentially using this Mishnah, talking about the Sanhedrin, to advise on New York State government policy. So that's interesting, right? That goes against what we've been saying this whole time. Here we're saying that there's three different systems, and we have to know which system we're talking about in order to properly put a quote in context. So isn't that going against all this for Avraham to take this reference to the Sanhedrin and apply it to the New York State government, which should be regulated by Dinim Ubnei Noach? So the answer can be found that it's L'shitaso, that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in New York Magazine is L'shitaso in Beis Yitzchak, a much better magazine, that the Beis Yitzchak, the YU Torah Journal, so Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had an article about Din by B'nai Noach, where he explained how he understood it. That, as we've established, so Mises Beis Din has many different functions. It could be a kapara, it could be to sustain the law, or it could be to protect society. When it comes to Dinim Ubnei Noach, so as we've made reference to a few times recently, it seems like it's primarily about protecting society. And that's why, last week, we talked about Makos, and we established that for Dinim Yisrael, the default is Malkos, which is more of a kapara-oriented punishment. While by B'nai Noach, we say Azaras and Zulim Misasa, and the default is Misa, which is more of a keep society safe kind of option. So there's different defaults reflecting the different purposes. So, says Rav Aaron, since that's the purpose of the Onesh is to keep society safe, what it means when we say Azaras and Zulim Misasa, what we mean is that the civil judge, the dying of the B'nai Noach society, he has the right and the obligation to do what's necessary to keep society safe. And that discretion goes ad v'ad b'chlal, goes up to including the death penalty. That if he decides that what we need to do to keep society safe is to execute people, so harashos piyado, that you would never call him a rotzeach. Right, that's not called Ritzicha, as long as it's a fair process, and an honest and legitimate process. If he decides that the Chiyuv Misa is what's necessary, that's not Ritzicha. But he also has the discretion to do less than that. That he can decide that society can be protected with life imprisonment or something else, so then he has the discretion to do that as well. Or that, let's say, to go back to the Ganavim, that we don't need to execute the Ganavim to keep people safe, we can do shorter term imprisonments. So then, that's also within his discretion.
The default for him would not be the death penalty.
It would start from there, but he has the right to say, listen, we don't need this right now as a society. He has the right to say that this is not serving our goals of keeping society safe, and something else would serve it better, and that would be within his discretion.
So what we saw in Rashi, et cetera, about the death penalty is being, everyone should be high on, let's say Tosfos sees B'nai Noach has have the default of the death penalty, and it doesn't seem to involve like an option of would this keep society safe or not? And maybe we can't know anything from that. You know what I'm referring to? Mm-hmm. And then Jews have Malkus in order to cover for those kind of things. So,
you mean, so what would be the default? We don't have any other.
It seems like it's just they get the death penalty.
No, I think it would still be with his discretion, whatever the society has the right to form these punishments. I was at an event the other night, and somebody came over to me. I think they heard me talk about this topic before. Probably saw this position, and somebody else had this position. I'm trying to remember who it was who was telling me this or who he was talking about, but someone else had the same idea that Ryan Soloveitchik said that essentially it is discretionary, and that doesn't mean that you're actually mechuyev to institute the death penalty. So I will tell you someone else who does say it, who doesn't use the same lumbus, but is clearly working off the same framework, and that was Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a tshuva, I think we put that in the list also, right? Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva, so that was written to another New York State governor, an earlier New York State governor, Governor Carey, where he essentially seems to be working off the same premise, that he's advising him on this issue, exactly what we've been talking about the whole time. What would you do if you had influence on a United States politician? What position would you try to impress? So you can see from Rav Moshe's tshuva that he believes the death penalty exists as a necessary tool, But it's clearly not saying that all the ganavim and all the adulterers should be executed. So it's clearly not working on the framework of asarasim and misarasim specifically. But a position similar to Rabbi and Soloveitchik's, even if he doesn't explain it exactly the same way, that the death penalty exists when necessary as the upper level of judicial discretion. But if the society decides that something else is more appropriate, so then that could also work. And therefore, we can understand what Rabbi Aaron was saying in New York Magazine. He's saying that the New York State should use their discretion, and they should be very careful. And to get an informed discretion, they could look to Jewish sources. They could see that the Talmud was very concerned about the death penalty being administered too loosely, and that there is very serious risks involved. And if you want to draw on that wisdom and inform your discretion with that, that was essentially the thrust of what he was saying. Which again, as L'shitaso, can be understood based on his halachic position as expressed in Beis Yisrael.
When the Mishnah says that Sanhedrin that murders in however many years is a bloody basin, they mean that in that basin who's putting people to death, common enough, it's too common, then it's they're not doing it for the good of society. Is that the svar that
maybe, or it means that they're not doing their job of being very, very careful as to when to administer it?
What if society, it's necessary for society?
And that may also mean, like you're saying, that maybe then part of their job is calibrating exactly where society needs it or not, and that's also part of their responsibility.
So it's hard to say that there's a number that's too bloody.
It means that a Sanhedrin that's effective should have a society where on the one hand people aren't murdering each other, but on the other hand they don't have to be executed too often in order to get that point across. Okay, any other questions about that? Okay, so there is more to say about this, which was relevant to this past week's parsha. Maybe we'll delay this next week, but we have a part three, which takes these principles and applies it to war issues, which was very relevant to this past week's parsha. This past week we read about the first war in history, the first war in Torah history, and what are the implications of that, and how does that draw upon what we talked about? There is a lot of overlap. So maybe for the sake of addressing that, we'll say a few words about that. Maybe we'll next Sunday, we'll keep our one partial off schedule, and maybe next Sunday we'll talk about that a little bit. Yeah, we'll see where we go with that.
Hi. So we're asking like the Ramadan that it's whatever religion these laws are?
That's a good question. I mean, if it's in terms of question, but it's, the Ramadan has the truth about it. It's not so obvious one way or the other.
If we let them choose when to apply the death penalty, like
in that. Yeah, it could be. I mean, it could be that that's how it plays out, but it seems to be an ongoing discussion whenever you get into a Choshen Mishpat issue, how exactly that should be applied. Alright, so we'll end here. God willing, tomorrow again we'll continue the topic of Tzilu Eidah and move on to the Mishnah.